Good morning. On Wednesday, a 90-minute phone call between Presidents Donald J. Trump and Vladimir Putin, all on how to end the war in Ukraine. Afterwards, new US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth told NATO allies in Brussels how Washington now sees Ukraine's long-term future.
We want, like you, a sovereign and prosperous Ukraine. But we must start by recognizing that returning to Ukraine's pre-2014 borders is an unrealistic objective. Chasing this illusionary goal will only prolong the war and cause more suffering. The United States does not believe that NATO membership for Ukraine is a realistic outcome of a negotiated settlement. Instead, any security guarantee must be backed by capable European and non-European troops. To be clear, as part of any security guarantee, there will not be U.S. troops deployed to Ukraine.
And when asked whether he saw Ukraine having an equal say in any peace deal, this response from President Trump.
It's an interesting question. I think they have to make peace. Their people are being killed, and I think they have to make peace. I said that was not a good war to go into, and I think they have to make peace. That's what I think.
With Claire on Thursday, this reaction from long-term Putin critic Bill Browder.
How do you think Vladimir Putin is today?
I think he's dancing the jig. They're popping the champagne in the Kremlin. This is a major, major win. Vladimir Putin launched an unprovoked war of aggression against a peaceful neighbor 3 years ago, killing many hundreds of thousands, if not more, people, took over a territory. And now all of a sudden, he's been granted an audience by the most important person in the free world, the President of the United States. He'll be meeting him in Saudi Arabia. The conversations are basically outlined in a way that supports a lot of his objectives. I think he's going to be very happy.
And after Trump phoned Putin, he then phoned Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. With Only on Morning Ireland, Christopher Miller from the Financial Times in Kyiv.
Now, you were with President Zelensky just before that call. Was Kyiv expecting Trump's peace plan?
You know, I think the speed at which all of this unfolded yesterday came as a shock to Ukrainians here and even the president's office. I was at President Zelensky's office while he was meeting with Scott Bessent, the new Treasury Secretary of the Trump administration. They were here to talk about part of Trump's peace deal, that element being this economic agreement that they want over precious rare earth minerals here in Ukraine. I think Zelensky... certainly was pleased to speak with Trump, but there's a lot of anxiety because it came after this lengthy call with President Vladimir Putin of Russia. And Zelensky has said repeatedly over the past 3 years of this war that he needs to be speaking with U.S. leaders, Western leaders, prior to their discussions with the Kremlin and with President Putin to lay out what Ukraine needs in order to defeat Russia, which launched this war of aggression in the first place.
So how then to react to events as they appear to be unfolding?
So in response, officially President Zelensky has been putting a brave face on it, but in reality, he's being asked to surrender a fifth of his sovereign territory, being told no to NATO, even though Ukraine gave up nuclear weapons, no to continued US military support for continuing the war or for a peace plan, a peacekeeping force. And his only option appears to be to agree and give up Ukraine's rare earths.
Well, you know, I think that would appear to many to be perhaps his and Ukraine's only option. But, you know, the Ukrainians do have agency here. They don't necessarily need to sign up for all of this. And we've heard President Zelensky say on multiple occasions that he's essentially rolled back his maximalist goal that you mentioned at the top there with Pete Hegseth's a clip from Brussels saying that it's unrealistic that Ukraine would retrieve all of its lost territory, territory taken as far back as 2014. What Zelensky has said is that they're willing to temporarily I mean, to view these territories occupied by Russia as temporarily occupied territories, but not to officially recognize them as Russian territory. Now, of course, that is what Vladimir Putin is going to want. And if that is a part of any kind of peace deal here, I think the Ukrainians are likely to reject that.
From Morning Ireland, well, on Liveline, Joe heard a range of views from Ukrainians living here.
I think it's a good idea to start some kind of negotiations because it may have some positive outcome. I think the only positive outcome is like stop people from dying, you know, and from further destruction of the country.
So it's not as easy as it sounds like, oh, yeah, Trump and Putin, they agree behind the back. Yeah, it's not going to be like that, no.
If Zelensky doesn't sign, but the new world order, so to speak, is imposed between Putin and Trump. Trump pulls out his military support.
Yeah, but there is a small continent in the middle of that called Europe. You know, Europe is not weak. Europe is the largest economy in the world, like altogether. You know, population-wise as well, huge. You know, so Europe is on the Ukrainian side, and Europe will continue. I'm pretty sure will continue to support Ukraine.
Yes, I agree. Actually, it's not only opinion. It was, I think, recent Danish intelligence report that Russia is preparing for a war. Exactly with the EU countries. So this is not our assumption. This is already proven by some of the European intelligence agencies. So I think the best case to try to prevent it is that Europe must realize that it has to be prepared for it. If you're hoping for negotiations, the war will happen because Russia understands only force. And if it doesn't see the other force, they don't care. They don't care about negotiations. Why should they?
What do you think, Oksana? Peace now at any price. It's too much blood has been shed. This is the. What do you think of that argument? That let's just.
Yes, definitely. I think too many people, too much blood. Everyone have a big hope it will be over.
Just as some of the voices on Liveline. And what of Europe in the middle of all of this? On the News at One, Rachel put this to Dr. Jenny Mathers, lecturer in international politics at Aberystwyth University.
The EU's head of foreign affairs, Kaja Kallas, saying this morning that if Ukraine decides to resist, Europe will come up with new initiatives to support it. What's that likely to mean?
Well, there's a whole range of things that it could mean. I mean, one idea that's been floated is that European money could be used to buy American-made weapons and ammunition. So, you know, supplies from the United States could continue to flow, but they would just be paid for in a different way. You know, another possibility is, you know, looking at global markets. Another is to ramp up, you know, sort of European defense production. Of course, that will take time, and time is what Ukraine doesn't really have. So I think probably a range of different measures, buying some things in and trying to really speed up the production line within Europe.
But as President Zelensky reiterated the view of nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, how realistic a possibility is that? On Drive Time, Sarah spoke to Ina Sovsun, a Ukrainian MP.
I think I don't want to think about that scenario, truth be told, because it is too scary. Because giving us back to Russia, to Moscow, is something I would never imagine seeing in my lifetime. I was born in the Soviet times in 1984. I went to school in an independent Ukraine. I never would have imagined that we might reconsider that back and giving back Ukraine to Russia's sphere of influence.
And is that how you feel today, that this is potentially the path that might that the country might be going down?
Well, I'm concerned that this might be the result of it. I do hope it will not happen. I do think that there are many politicians in the US who understand, after all, that if they give in to Putin, it will not be seen as US victory. It will be seen as Putin's victory. And that will undermine U.S. influence globally. So I do hope that this we will not get to that. But I see that the risks are very high. And that is why we are very much alarmed right now.
Yeah, I know former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who we've spoken to plenty of times on this programme, he's been saying in the United States that Trump has effectively surrendered to Putin. But I don't know to what extent, as you say, the people of America will see it that way. Finally, what is the next step, or what should be the next step? What can be the next step, do you think, for Ukraine? Or what does Ukraine need perhaps from the EU now?
Well, the EU really needs to step in, right? Now, because if the deal that is being discussed now is really made and Ukraine's interests left unprotected, then it's up for Europe to decide whether they're willing to step in or to allow Putin to take over part of Ukraine and then see how far he will choose to go next. Because the next steps of Putin are going to take place in Europe. And I think Europe should be really aware of the risks they're facing.
Ukrainian MP Ina Sovsun on Thursday's Drive Time. We will leave that there for now. Almost every week at the moment, we have someone pretending to be someone they're not, ye oldie catfish. But in this instance, there was an all too human story of loneliness behind the deception. With Oliver, John Marr, a journalist with the Irish Independent, and one day he was contacted by an ex.
Well, just before Christmas, an ex-girlfriend of mine said to me, "I'm surprised that you're back on dating apps." And I said, "Well, I'm not." And she said her sister had seen me on Bumble. And then she said to me, "I knew it wasn't you because there's no way you'd use that particular picture. It was an old newspaper photograph, which I always hated." And she sent me through the screen grab. I found it hilarious. I mean, I did initially. Yeah. I did think, okay, the guy, he says he's 46 and considerably shorter than me. So I'm a bit older, but a bit taller
as
well.
Tall man, yep.
So I kind of thought, nah, it's a bit odd. And I kind of let it go. And then...
But he was calling himself John.
He was calling himself John and using the picture that was taken about 8 years ago. And it's funny, when you don't know, your mind goes into strange places. So I was thinking, I wonder, is this a friend maybe who's having a laugh, or somebody who I've irritated in some way,
yeah,
who's trying to get their own back at me. It's funny, having gone from hilarity, I kind of, as I was going to bed that night, was quite freaked by it. Now,
And with a nose for a story, he wrote an article about it for the newspaper, and it would turn out that the same photo had been used on Tinder. Mary, not her real name, read that article and decided to do a little sting operation of her own.
She decides she's going to talk to him, knowing full well that he's fake. And then she lets me know. But she sends me all the screen grabs of the conversations. And if I thought it was freaky to see a screenshot of a dating profile, it's nothing like seeing conversations with a little avatar of yourself, of an old picture.
Yeah.
While I was asleep the night before, this catfish John was having this lengthy conversation about everything and anything.
Long story short, he gives an ultimatum saying he wants to talk to Catfish John. He gets a call, but it's from Catfish John's solicitor, who warns that this man is having something of a crisis. But eventually, the two Johns do arrange a phone call, and an explanation of sorts is forthcoming.
He said to me he was very fearful of going on dating apps as himself, using his own photograph. So this is the one part that I struggle to believe, but he said to me, "I'm mortified to say this to you, but I will say it to you." He said, "I Googled John and Beard, did a Google image search, and eventually I found your picture." And he said, "You actually look quite like me."
Really?
"But not sufficiently like me." And I thought, I'm going to put that up. But when I have conversations with women online, I will tell them everything about my life. And that's the thing he said, that everything I said to Mary over the preceding days was true, down to the car that he drove, the job that he did, the place he was from or where he lives now, the kind of hobbies, all that stuff. He says, absolutely true. And I said, what was the end game here? And he said, the end game was, well, never to meet anybody that I connected with online, but simply to have conversations. And he said to me, "I know this sounds really sad, but it helped me. It was like therapy. I was these people." And he said to me, "I feel so sorry that I duped them." But he said, "They helped me in a very challenging period of my life. where I would simply have conversations about the real problems that he was having with marital breakdown and so forth. And he said, that was getting me out of a hole. That was making me feel a connection. He said, I was just so lonely. He says, I am so lonely. I feel so isolated.
And while Marr had sympathy for this man, he also told him about the impact of his deception on his own life and how in particular it had scared his daughter, as there were photos of her online too.
And she's thinking, could that have been used? And I say this to him and he breaks down.
Right, that really
gets him. It gets him because he's got children and he kind of realised
what he had done.
What he had done. And he said, I had no idea that when I took that picture, it would have the ramifications that it did. And I believe him. And then there's something I say to him, look, how long has this been going on for? Because like I only heard about it in December. And he paused and he said, it's about a year.
Wow.
And I said, how many women did you connect with? And he says, I lost count. A lot.
However, he never met any of these women.
Whenever it reached the point where somebody wanted to meet him, he'd try to break it off. And he said there was the pain in that as well, because you're building these connections. And I said to him, you've got to be yourself. You've got to go tomorrow and create dating apps as you, with your own picture, and get on with your life and kind of stop living through somebody else's image.
You were very decent to him, very sound about it.
I just thought there's a lot of discussion about men's mental health these days, and mm-hmm. so much of it is just virtue signalling. And I thought here is an opportunity to actually be empathetic, to show real empathy, because I did feel for this guy. Like a lot of people, I've been through some difficult times in my life, and I just felt sorrow that he was in this position. And I thought, let's do something kind.
In fact, the two men might even meet for a coffee. John Marr with Oliver. Now, if you were paying homage to love last night, fair play. And as for the lust, what would Jesus say?
Let's get straight to the chase. Yep. Do we know, what is God's view on sex?
Straight in, no messin'. Dervil MacDonald on Our Divine Sparks, and she was putting that to Jacob Erickson, Assistant Professor of Theological Ethics at the School of Religion at Trinity.
Well, there's a lot of input and takes on that. I think most people immediately go to negative associations, and that it's
shame,
that sex is awkward to talk about. Most people, when they're thinking about histories of sex in the Christian tradition, immediately start thinking about Adam and Eve and
that
the long
woman. that woman.
That, yeah, the lust and desire and all of the sin and death that follows. And of course, that's a long historical interpretation that a lot of folks take up.
Oh, indeed they do. But is there any religion out there that might plausibly be described as, whisper it, sex positive?
While we focus on the Adam and Eve story and Christian traditions on one hand, just a chapter before that, you get a God who is creating bodies, diverse bodies, and celebrating and calling them to come forth and live in flourishing ways. And that sort of early call to honor diverse bodies includes sexuality and desire. Later on, you get the Song of Songs, where you have these two lovers courting each other, unmarried lovers talking in very erotic ways. In Jewish traditions, for example, sex can be a moral obligation, and it doesn't have to be without shame, or it can be for the sake of pleasure.
And a sacred act.
And a sacred act, yeah, exactly. And some folks will think of things like the Kama Sutra in Hindu traditions. But
I was waiting to see would it come up or not.
Yeah, of course. But there are problems with that. And feminist scholars of Hinduism have said, you know, that there are issues with that text in that it perpetuates the caste system, that it perpetuates its own version of patriarchy. So I think all traditions are indeterminate. And the question is, again, how do you move them and think with them in ways that promote flourishing?
Really interesting from Our Divine Sparks. And you can never have enough of flourishing. Back in a bit. Welcome back. It had started on Monday with spelling, pronunciation, or rather misspelling and mispronunciation. Hopsital, anyone?
Difficult word to spell, diarrhea. Yours sincerely, Michael. Interesting. We got two on diarrhea. Diarrhea. I heard of a teacher getting a sick note from a parent involving the word diarrhea. She made three crossed out attempts to spell it and finally wrote the runs. I worked in bank. Customers seldom got 90 correct when writing checks. Laura says broccoli. And my spelling is good, but pronunciation of some words catch me out. I avoid saying tragedy as I say tragedy. Yes. You know, as children, you say hostable. And a lot of children say it, so there must be a linguistic reason for that.
And the next day, the expert.
You're the man I've been looking for 20 years, David. I don't know if you know this.
No, I hadn't noticed, but I'm glad you found me now. Yeah. How can I help you, Ray?
No pressure. That's Professor David Crystal, linguist and author of Spell It Out, The Singular Story of English Spelling. So, why do we misspell certain words?
It's all to do with the history of English, of course, or the history of almost any language. I mean, you could say the same about Irish and Welsh and all sorts of things. But with English, we've got a particular problem. When it started, you know, back in Old English times, Anglo-Saxon times, 1,000 years ago, it was pretty regular. You know, for every sound, there was a letter and you knew where you were. And then, you know, your history, 1066 and all that, along come the French and they beat us up. And then their scribes started to change the spelling to make it more Frenchified. Mm. And that made it a bit more complicated. And then there were other problems later in the history of the language. And each sort of century brought a new layer of difficulty onto English spelling. And so we end up with this sort of messy situation we have today.
There's nobody in charge, David, really, is there?
Absolutely not. I mean, there was an attempt to do so back in the 18th century. And, you know, over the years, people have said, let's have an academy or something like that to sort it all out. But the problem with English, you see, is that it became a global language. And as soon as it did that, different countries decided to go their own way. And the biggest thing, of course, is America versus Britain. You know, you know the problem here. How do you spell colour? Mm. Well, C-O-L-O-U-R or C-O-L-O-R. And that all started in the 18th century and now is massive because of the influence of American English. A lot of those American spellings have now started to influence British spelling. So the situation's got even more complicated. So there have been lots of proposals for spelling reform to try and standardize the situation. None have ever been successful.
And then they moved here. The real reason David was on the line.
The reason I've been looking for you for 20 years is this question, and I don't know if you have the answer. Why do certain areas have certain accents? We know they exist, but why do they form in the first place?
It's all to do with identity. There have always been accents in language right from the very beginning. There are two drivers that force language along. One is the need for intelligibility. We have to understand each other. Mm. But the other big driver is we have to show everybody where we're from, because community is so important. An accent is the best badge of community that we've got. Because think about it. If you wanted to show you were Irish, say, or I wanted to show I was Welsh, how would you do it? Well, you could do it by dressing in a certain way or wearing a big badge saying, I am from Ireland or something like that. But you have to buy your badge and or whatever, or your clothes. And in any case, you can't see them in the dark. Now, there's only one thing that you can perceive in the dark as well as in the light, and that's your voice.
Yes.
And so an accent developed in order to express the identity of a group.
Mm.
And of course, in any language, there are hundreds of accents, sometimes just down the road.
Not enough for Ray, though. He had a theory to which David had a response.
In here in Ireland, I'm from the Midlands, which is flat, and all the accents are flat. Now, that's probably coincidental. Whereas the topography is more mountainous, there's more of an up and down sort of a lilt. Is there anything in that at all?
No, not really, because there are lots of examples. Not, I'm afraid not. There are lots of examples of it going the other way round.
Yes.
Shut down in flames. But if you are one of those people that goes to Middleton for the weekend and comes back talking cock, bye, don't worry. You're just being accommodating.
you accommodate to the accent that you're talking to in two different ways. One way, if you like the person you're talking to, you'll pick in up some of their habits and start to talk like them. If you don't like the person you're talking to, you go the other way and you make your own accent as different as possible from the one that you're talking to.
Very interesting. And on Liveline, more on language, this time exemptions for learning Irish for people with dyslexia. Now, there was a lot of debate about resources and how best to learn any language. But towards the end of the programme, this contribution.
Sean O'Hagan is a former Gaelic school principal. Are the exemptions going up, Sean?
I think they're rocketing, Joe, and I was president of Gaelic AUKUS. We were making this point consistently over the last number of years. You know, the reality is, as far as I'm concerned, this is the introduction of the taking away of compulsory Irish by stealth. And there are a small number of very genuine cases. Some of them have been outlined today. But I do think one of the most important figures is that 80% of people with exemptions are taking a foreign language to leaving cert level. Uh-huh. Now, linguistically, that makes no sense. You know, I think one of the points that was made there about Irish being particularly phonetically difficult. In fact, people like Paul Godier and internationally, people would say one of the hardest languages to learn from scratch is the English language because of the huge number of exceptions that there are in the language. Yeah. Huge, I mean, words like though, T-H-O-U-G-H, Joe, exist in the English language. Yeah, and I'll just tell me how that works phonetically. And I was a learning support teacher for 10 years dealing with children with dyslexia, and I saw the real difficulties they had with English as well as Irish, but nobody's suggesting that they have an exemption from English.
And even, you know, the number of silent letters in the English language.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Bringing us to Joe McHugh, who you might remember back in 2014 was appointed as Fine Gael Minister for Natural Resources, the Gaeltacht and the Islands. He didn't have a lot of cúpla focal. He went off to learn Irish.
Everybody who, you know, had Irish were texting me in Irish. They were sending reefos in Irish. They were sending emails in Irish. They were, you know, going to the shop in Carrigart. They were, you know, Chimertan, you, Joe, because, you know, at the time my mother was in the hospital. Could you and Scale feed the water? What's the story with your mother? All this was happening. So I couldn't miss out. It was full immersion. And there is the potential for people to fully immerse themselves in the language. And this is what I go into in the book, Oliver. I do go into those little steps, those little techniques. And a lovely Irish saying, you know, we use as English, the eye avoids what it doesn't see. So I drove from Donegal yesterday evening. I wasn't looking at the English writing on the signage. I was looking at the ones at Skellige.
Isn't that funny? That's how your brain has been you've rewired it.
Rewired it, correct, yeah.
And as he told Oliver, his new book is called Bay to All Right, an Irish Language Journey. And along that journey, some regional detours and differences.
So that was one of the most intriguing thing about this Irish language journey, that the dialects were, it was nearly on a parish-to-parish basis. And there's big arguments. And I remember being in Reid in the Gaeltacht one day and I used Foscailche for Oscailche. And this guy reared up at me saying, you don't say Foscailche. It's only the Gador ones say Foscailche. And, you know,
you didn't have the right,
to say it. So look, that was the fun element of the learning. You'll hear Gower in Connemara for dog, but Madra for dog. But you go up to Donegal, it's like West Donegal and Big Prince, it's Madhu.
Madhu.
And we don't say Shunach, we don't say Fox, we say Red Dog, we say Madhurua.
Right. Even the words that are written down the same, like Canuck, we would have thought it's the same, but in Donegal it's Crook.
It's always an R. Yes.
It's always an R sound.
Crook, yeah. Crook follow, yeah. Yeah.
That's one that got me in school now.
Yeah, yeah.
They're the things that terrify us. But you're here to say, relax.
Yeah, and look, make that part of the learning journey. Like, I mean, you know, we say Milchina and Donegal for terrible, and Connemara they'll say Ufasa, we'll say Fosta, they'll say Freshin. And a lovely one is, like, you know, people, I think we all know the word Donna because teachers were kind of fairly fond of using that one for bowl.
Local Donna, yeah.
Yeah, but Donegal's Dolaba.
Dolaba.
Yeah, Dolaba. Really, really express that. I loved using that with the kids when they were younger and when they were Dolaba.
That's what they know that word well, do they?
Joe McHugh with Oliver, and it's funny how a week pans out because all of that as the unexpected tee up for this Oscailge Dáil spat.
Well, our two spires, Sotla Marag, Willan, Tata Dara, Ginchin Brega, reached Nilead Run, Crean, Enecher. Saavedra Dorje.
Deputy, there is no point of order.
There is actually. The Taoiseach, I think, took advantage, perhaps, of you not following.
Deputy, it's not a point of order.
He accused me, he called me a liar.
I did
we make inches on air in it. He said,
excuse
three
me.
Grade candidate. So I would like him to remove that point, from the record.
Taoiseach,
thank you.
I would ask you to withdraw. If you made those remarks, I am not aware that you. Did you call Deputy MacDonald? Right. Well, I would say. Well, that's. There is a salient. Please resume your seat.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. Sometimes it's all about the talk, the debates on the one hand, on the other, the discussions, the analysis, and yes, the scraps I think you'll find. It just doesn't stop, does it? Unless, of course, you go to the music. So, we are going to treat ourselves this morning with some good tunes. Kicking us off, Creedon with The Most Gentle of Rants.
Do you ever get that feeling sometimes that it's just like, no matter where you turn, there's always someone trying to tell you something or sell you something or whatever? Here's John Prine.
I don't want your big French fry. I don't want your car. I don't want to buy no soap from no washed up movie star. You are so much louder than the show I want to hear. With your sugarless gum, gee, but I'm dumb, non-alcoholic beer. It's enough to make a grown man blow up his own TV. Quit a hollering at me. Quit a hollering at me. I heard of you the first time, I heard of myself say, seems like the little woman is getting bigger every day. You don't have to tell the neighbors, a little silence ain't no sin. They already think my name is where in the hell you've been. Louder, 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 louder constantly. Quit a hollering at me. Quit a hollering at me.
Feeling your pain, sir. Feeling your pain. And on Movies and Musicals, Aideen said a happy birthday to John Williams, who was turning 93. And she played this clip of Williams receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Film Institute. And he was talking about his relationship with director Steven Spielberg.
I have a favorite Steven Spielberg story that I want to share with you. And that has to do with the film Schindler's List, which you will all remember. And Steven came back with his film to show me the first cut, as he always does. And we went to his projection room, and the purpose of this was to see the film and then discuss the music for the film. And you'll remember the film. It's the story of Oskar Schindler, who's a German civilian who protected and employed potential victims of the Holocaust. Powerful masterpiece of a film. And the film ends in the state of Israel, you'll remember, and the survivors and their children go to the graveside of Oskar Schindler to place stones on the graveside to honor the memory of Oskar Schindler. And the lights came up and the film was over and it was time for Stephen and me to begin to talk about the role of the music. And I was so overwhelmed by the film, I really could not speak. And I went out and walked around the building for a few minutes to gather myself and came back in to start the meeting with Stephen. And I said, Stephen, this is truly a great film. And you need a better composer than I am for this film. And he said very sweetly, I know, but they're all dead.
And on the rolling wave with Aoife, T on the bonnet of the car. No, not the name of a reel, but it could be. Here's Martin Hayes on his time with the Tulla Cayley Band.
Tell me about the tea ceremony that was involved in tours.
Yeah. He lives in Tulla. His name is Matty Ryan. He was an accordion player, and he, like when I was a teenager, he was the main man kind of in the band, and he was the driver as well. There were two cars. There was a kind of a West North Clare car that would drive, and an East Clare car that would drive to locations. But Matty, anyway, you know, liked his cars. He was a mechanic. And but we had a drummer called Jack McDonald, and Jack used to bring a flask of tea and biscuits, and for every night, you know, he was great. But Matty didn't want this going on in the car, you know. So Jack resorted to bringing a tablecloth and agreeing that we would have the tea and the biscuits on the bonnet of the car, you know, late at night after somewhere. We'd have to pull in and have tea, like standing around a car. Like, I'm, there are loads of places around the countryside that I can still recognise as, oh, God, I remember we used to actually pull there and, like, have the tea, you know.
It must have been quite a sight to see.
I think so, yeah. I think so. Like, how badly did we need tea and biscuits, like, that we were willing to stop the progress of getting home and, like, stop the car, get out, put a tablecloth on the bonnet of the car and have tea and biscuits.
Oh, the ritual is important. Yes, it's important. Yeah.
And if you did don the black beret and head over to John Kelly, as you might expect, he's hanging with the coolest of cats.
I talk sometimes about the programme's comedy correspondent. He sends me jokes and the odd musical suggestion, but I'm not at liberty to say, as always, for security reasons, I can't tell you who the programme's comedy correspondent is. Very important person, but you wouldn't believe me. If I told you, you wouldn't believe me. Very, 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 very important person. But I can't tell you. But I was visiting with that very, 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 very important comedy correspondent quite recently, and he was playing the Tortoise album, and I thought, there's a man after my own heart. So I've been thinking ever since I must play something from it again on the programme. I haven't played this in a while. From the album TNT from Tortoise.
And in case you were wondering,
Chicago-based collective. That's what I should have become part of a long time ago. A Chicago-based collective. Why didn't you, says you?
His secret side hustle. And with Sean on Arena, Candy Staten. Now, this was a cracking interview, and her new album sounds really good. But it would be downright wrong not to ask about her disco classic, Young Hearts Run Free.
You know, it's such an upbeat song, that, Candy, but when you listen to the lyrics of, particularly in
it's
the chorus.
Sad.
Yeah. And it was a sad time in your life.
Yeah. It was I was in with this. Whew, I even hate to go back there. It's so dark, you know. But I was with this guy, and he was threatening to kill everybody in my family if I left him because he was pimping me. And so, I was telling David Crawford, we were doing the first album with Warner Brothers. I had known David for many years. We would be sitting down. We'd done some of the sides for the album. But we were sitting down eating lunch, and we would go to lunch quite often. And I would tell him what I was going through. I was just dumping. I was just, you know, listening to somebody just in the open ears. I wanted to tell somebody what I was going through because you can't talk to everybody. And so I told David, and I realized he was writing. He just kept writing down stuff, and he would look up at me and he would write it down. We would eat, and he would look up at me, and I would keep talking, and he would write it down. And he took that song, the words that I was saying to him, and made a song out of it.
Yeah. And when you were singing that song at that time, did it help you pluck up the courage to do what you had to do, which was to get out of that relationship and move on with your life? Did singing the song actually feed into that?
Oh, yes. Yes, it gave me courage. You know, I was with him at the time. And I would listen to it myself. And I said, I got to get rid of this man. I don't know how I'm going to do it. And nobody's going to get hurt. And I just figured out a way to get rid of him. Say I'm gonna leave.
Just can't break away. You just can't break away.
What a song and what a backstory. But we are almost at a finish here on Playback, and you can't talk to Candy Staten without this.
You Got the Love. This is the song that just keeps giving for you, isn't it?
isn't that amazing?
So
how did it start?
How did it start, and where has it gone to since?
It started as a commercial, actually. It's just so strange how songs hit records are made. You can't predict a hit record. It started as Dick Gregory had out this, and I know you might have heard this story before. Yeah. But he had out this diet called the Bohemian Diet, and he was trying to get a guy that was 1,000 pounds down to 195. That was a task. And so I met him in Nassau, and he asked me, we were at a conference there, and he said, I got a song that I'd like for you to try to sing for me, but we're going to do a video. That's all it's going to be used for is a video. I said, oh, okay. He said, well, I'll bring you to Chicago, and we can do it, and we'll go from there. So he asked me, well, how much are you going to charge me? I said, well, I gave him the amount I wanted. And he said, no. I said, so a friend of mine was there. He's like an attorney. He said, well, how about half the publishing? And that's where it stopped. And he said, okay, fine. So we signed the contract, and I did the song. It laid dormant for 10 years.
Yeah, so you
nobody
got
nobody would play it.
You signed for half the publishing rights. In the 1990s, The Source did a remix of it. It was used in what we thought was the last episode of Sex and the City. It was used there. And then Florence and the Machine came along and...
came along and did it again. And it's been done, I don't know how many times. Sean, I can't keep up with it. Somebody's always doing it. I mean, and I'm like, thank you. I appreciate that. I just go to the mailbox and pick up my check.
So maybe when your mama said, it's going to rain, maybe she knew it was going to rain a few dollars later on in life
maybe
as well.
Maybe so. Maybe that's what she meant. One of these days, honey, it's going to rain on you.
A bit of a legend, and that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Sometimes I feel like throwing my hands up in the air. I know I can count on you. Sometimes I feel like saying, Lord.